This is Audible.
HarperCollins presents How to Kill Your Family by Bella Mackey, read by Charlie Clive and Paul Panting. Unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood. William Shakespeare, Macbeth. Prologue. Limehouse Prison is, as you might imagine, horrible. Except maybe you can't imagine it, not really. There are no games consoles and flat-screen TVs, as you have surely read about in the newspapers. There's no friendly communal vibe, no sisterly tribe. The atmosphere is usually frantic, hideously loud, and it often feels as though a fight will break out at any moment. From the beginning, I've tried to keep my head down. I stay in my cell as much as possible, in between meals that could optimistically be described as occasionally digestible, and attempt to avoid my roommate, as she tiresomely likes to be called. Kelly is a woman who likes to chat. On my first day here, 14 long months ago, she sat on my bunk, squeezed my knee with her horribly long fingernails, and told me that she knew what I'd done and thought it was fantastic. Such praise was a pleasant surprise, given that I expected an onslaught of violence as I approached the looming gates of this shabby place. Ah, the innocence of someone who only knows about prison from watching one fairly low-budget TV drama. From this initial introduction, Kelly decided that I was her new best friend, and worse, a trophy cellmate. At breakfast, she will bustle up to me, linking arms and whispering to me as if we are in the middle of a confidential discussion. I've heard her talking to other prisoners, her voice dropping to a stage whisper as she intimates that I've confessed all the details of my crime to her. She wants leverage and respect from the other girls, and if anyone can provide her with it, the Morton murderer can. It is immensely tiresome. I know I say that Kelly professes to know all about my crime, but perhaps that diminishes my deed somewhat. To me, the word crime sounds shabby, inelegant and commonplace. Shoplifters commit crimes. When you go at 35 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour zone in order to get a tepid latte before you start another dull day at the office, you're committing a crime. I did something much more ambitious. I conceived and carried out a complex and careful plan, the origins of which were set in motion long before the unpleasant circumstances surrounding my birth. And given that I had so little to do in this ugly and uninspiring cage, one misguided therapist suggested I attend a spoken word class, and I was gratified when my mere expression ensured that she never made such an offer again. I have decided to tell my story. This is no easy task, given that I have no state-of-the-art laptop such as I am used to. When my lawyer recently presented me with some tentative light at the end of this tunnel, I felt like I should mark the time I've spent here and write down some of what I've done. A trip to the canteen provided me with a thin notepad and a tired biro, taking £5 off my weekly spend of £15.50. Forget magazine articles breezily suggesting you save money by scrimping on takeout coffee. If you really want to learn to budget properly, spend some time at Limehouse. The writing might be pointless, but I must do something to ease the stultifying boredom of this place, and I'm hopeful that Kelly and her interminable group of ladies, as she insists on calling them, will stop asking if I want to watch reality TV in the rec room with them if I seem intent on a task. "Sorry, Kelly," I will say. "I'm writing important case notes up for my appeal. Let's talk later." I am confident that the merest hint that I might tell her some juicy nugget about my story will have her tapping her nose like a ludicrous character in a Dick Francis novel and leave me to it. Of course, my story is not for Kelly. I doubt she'd have the capacity to understand what motivated me to do as I did. My story is just that, mine. Though I know readers would lap it up if I ever published it, not that I ever could. But it's nice to know that people would pore over it nonetheless. It would be a bestseller, and the masses would rush to the shops, hoping to know more about the attractive and tragic young woman who could commit such a terrible act. The tabloids have been running pieces on me for months now. The public doesn't seem to tire of the two-bit psychologists willing to diagnose me from a distance, or the occasional contrarian who will defend my actions to outrage on Twitter. The general public are so enthralled by my actions that they are even willing to watch a hastily cobbled together Channel 5 documentary about me, which included a fat astronomer explaining that my star sign predicted my case. He got my star sign wrong. So I know that people would fall on my words. Without any attempt on my part at an accurate explanation, my case has already become a notorious one. And ironically, that is without anyone knowing about my real crimes. The justice system in this country is a joke, and there is nothing which illustrates that more than this one sentence. I have killed several people, some brutally, others calmly, and yet I currently languish in jail for a murder I did not commit. The crimes I did orchestrate, if known about, would ensure that I was remembered for decades, perhaps even centuries, if the human race manages to hold on for that long. Dr. Crippen, Fred West, Ted Bundy, Lizzie Borden, and me, Grace Bernard. Actually, that displeases me somewhat. I'm not an amateur or an imbecile. I'm someone who, if you saw me on the street, you'd gaze at admiringly. Perhaps that's why Kelly clings to me instead of punching the living daylights out of me as I expected. Even in here, I retain a certain elegance and a foi d'oeuvre that those weaker than I desperately wish to break through. Despite my crimes, I'm told I've received letters by the sackful, professing love, admiration, asking me where I bought the dress I wore on the first day of my trial. Roxander, if you're interested. That terrible Prime Minister's wife wore something very similar just a month later, unfortunately. Often hate mail. Sometimes mad shit, where the writer thinks I've been sending them messages through the air. People seem to really wish to know me, to impress me, to emulate me. If not in my actions, then at least in my sartorial choices. It matters not, since I don't ever read any of it. My lawyer scoops it all up and takes it away. I've no interest, really, in what I represent to strangers sad enough to put pen to paper and write to me. Perhaps I'm being too kind to the general public, ascribing to them a more complex set of emotions than they deserve. Maybe the reason for such sustained and frenzied interest in my case is best ascribed to Occam's razor, the theory that the simplest answer is usually the correct one. In which case, my name will live on long after I am dead for the most prosaic reason of all, merely because the idea of a love triangle seems so dramatic and grubby. But when I think about what I actually did, I feel somewhat sad that nobody will ever know about the complex operation that I undertook. Getting away with it is highly preferable, of course, but perhaps when I'm long gone, someone will open an old safe and find this confession. The public would reel. After all, almost nobody else in the world can possibly understand how someone, by the tender age of 28, can have calmly killed 6 members of her family, and then happily carried on with the rest of her life, never to regret a thing. Chapter 1. I step off the plane and encounter that glorious blast of hot air that British people always dramatically exclaim at when they land somewhere hot and remember that much of the rest of the world enjoys a climate which doesn't just veer between grey and cold. I'm adept at moving through airports quickly, and today that's especially true, since I'm keen to avoid the man I had the misfortune of sitting next to during the flight. Amir introduced himself the moment I'd finished putting my seatbelt on. A guy in his mid-30s, he was wearing a shirt which was stretched desperately over his almost comical pectoral muscles, and he'd inexplicably paired it with shiny tracksuit bottoms. The worst part of his outfit, the cherry on the whole mess, was the pair of sliders he had on instead of shoes. Gucci pool shoes with matching socks. Jesus. I considered asking the hostess if I could sit somewhere else, but she was nowhere to be found, and I was already trapped between the embellished He-Man and the window as the plane started to taxi. Amir was on his way to Puerto Banús, as was I, although I would never have told him so. He was 38, did something with nightclubs, and was fond of saying that he liked to go large. I closed my eyes as he bored on about the Marbella lifestyle and told me about the challenges of having his favourite cars shipped over for the summer season. Despite my body language, my aisle mate didn't let up, forcing me to finally engage. I was going to visit my best friend, I told him. No, she wasn't in Puerto Banús, but further inland, and we were unlikely to venture into town to experience the delights of the glitter nightclub. Do you need a car? The man mountain asked me. I could give you a sick one to ride around in. Just let me know and I'll sort you out with a nice Merc for your holidays. As politely as I could, I declined, before firmly announcing that I needed to get some work done before we landed. As we started our descent, Amir saw his opportunity and reminded me to shut my laptop. Once again, I was drawn into conversation, remembering to be careful not to mention my name or give him any personal information. I was furious at this attention, having deliberately dressed in black trousers, a shirt, and no makeup for the flight so as to draw as little notice as possible. No jewellery, no personal touches, nothing that might stand out in a person's mind were they to be questioned. Not that they would be. I'm just a young girl going on holiday to Marbella, like so many others this summer. The flight was all Amir can have of me, and even that was taken, not given. So now I'm squeezing past people, flashing smiles as I push to the front of the passport queue and head straight for baggage reclaim. I position myself behind a pillar as the room fills up and look down at my phone. A few minutes later, I see my bag and grab it before turning on my heels and walking purposefully towards the exit. And then I have a thought and stop in my tracks. I'm leaning by the railings outside the airport when Amir emerges. His face brightens as he sucks his stomach in and puffs up his chest. "I was looking for you," he says, and I note the bright gold watch as he gesticulates. "Yeah, sorry, I'm in such a rush to get to my friend in time for lunch, but I couldn't leave without saying goodbye," I reply. "Well, let's have that night out. Give me your digits and we'll link." Absolutely not a chance, but I have to keep him sweet if I'm going to get what I want from this. "I've got a new phone, Amir. I can't remember the number for the life of me. Tell you what, you give me yours and I'll be in touch." I smile and touch his arm lightly. After I've stored it and declined his offer of a lift, I wave goodbye. "Amir," I call as he walks away. "That offer of a car, is it still on?" I arrive at my rented apartment just under 2 hours later, a fairly pain-free drive from the airport in my hire car. I found it on Airbnb and arranged to pay the landlady in cash so as not to have a record under my name. She was fine with a private booking when I said I'd pay double. It's painfully expensive, especially in the high season. But I only have this week booked off work and I'm keen to get on with my plan, so I'm throwing money at the problem. The flat is tiny and stifling. The aesthetic is very much reminiscent of an 80s cosmetic clinic, but with added china dolls. I'm desperate to see the ocean and stretch my legs, but I have a limited time here and there's work to be done. I've done my research, as much as you can do on two old bigots who have an inconsiderately minimal online presence, and I've got a good idea where they'll be tonight. It seems, from the little I could glean from Kathleen's Facebook page, the poor love has a public account. Blessings be that old people do not understand privacy settings. That between feeling angry at the amount of Spanish people living in Spain, the Artemis seniors spend most of their time shuffling between a restaurant called Villa Bianca, which is right on the waterfront, and a casino called Dinero, just outside of town. I've booked a table at the restaurant for dinner. Let me be clear here. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm 24. I've been thinking about how to best avenge my mother for many years now, and this is the biggest step I've taken so far. Mostly, I've been working my way up the career ladder, saving money, researching the family, and trying to get myself into a position where I can get closer to them. It's been helpful, but mundane. Of course, I'm willing to make these sacrifices in order to get closer to my end goals, but my God, it's hard to pretend I care about customer surveys and participate in the optional, read mandatory, team bonding drinks on Fridays. If I'd known I'd have to drink Jaeger bombs with people who willingly work in marketing, I'd have given myself more time to research trepanation first. Maybe that's why I'm rushing this big move, desperate to prove to myself that I've made inroads and can do what I've been saying I will since I was 13. And yet, I am woefully underprepared. I envisaged that by the time I got to Marbella, I'd have a firm plan in place, carefully plotted my route, the timings, and have invested in an incredible disguise. Instead, I am holed up in a flat which smells like your family hamster died underneath a wardrobe and your mother didn't know what the smell was and has been going mad with the bleach for 6 months. I have a plan in my mind, but no idea whether I'll be able to pull it off. I have a wig that I bought at a cosmetics shop in Finsbury Park, which looked convincing enough under the store strip lighting, but appears worryingly flammable in the Spanish sun. Despite this free-floating anxiety about my lack of preparation, excitement spreads through me. As I fix my wig and apply my makeup, I feel as though I'm getting ready for a brilliant date, and not at all like I'm on the way to kill my grandparents. That was overly dramatic, of course. I'm not going to kill them tonight. That would be foolish. I need to see them, listen to their conversation, see if they drop any hints about their plans this week. I need to drive the route to their villa a few times, and importantly, I need to pick up the promised car from Amir. That car is either a sign that I am stupidly chaotic and should postpone my plans, or it was a little gift from some unknown deity. Let's see which. I decided long ago that Kathleen and Jeremy Artemis would be the first to leave us. This was for several reasons, really. The first being that they're old, so it doesn't matter as much. Old people who do nothing but drain their pensions and stultify in their favourite armchairs isn't a brilliant advertisement for humanity, in my opinion. Great that we've worked out how to make people live longer with medical intervention and healthier lifestyles. Unfortunately, they will become useless bed blockers who get more and more mean-spirited until they are nothing more than bigoted beasts of burden living in the room you wanted to make a study. Don't be shocked. I know you think it too. Enjoy your life and shuffle off this coil around 70. Only the very boring would want to live to be 100, the only reward an impersonal and brief letter from the Queen. So really, I'm doing everyone a favour. They are old and disposable, and they live staggeringly useless lives. Wine at lunch, naps, a trip to the boutiques in town to buy hideous jewellery and gaudy watches. He golfs, she spends a lot of her time getting things injected into her face, which has had the strange effect of making her look like a very old toddler. A waste of life. And that's all before I tell you how racist they are. Oh, fuck it, you can imagine. They live in Marbella and yet they speak no Spanish. There you go. No more explanation needed. Of course, I have skin in this game. I'm not Harold Shipman, merrily going around killing off as many geriatrics as I can. I only want to kill two of them. The rest are safe to keep watching Emmerdale and buying terrible presents for grandchildren who resent their boring visits. These people are technically my grandparents, though I've never met them and they have never bought me as much as a Toblerone. But they do know about me. Let me explain. I wasn't aware of this for many years, imagining that my father Simon had successfully kept me a secret. But my mother's friend Helene was in London for a visit recently, and over a bottle of wine she confessed that she'd paid them a visit shortly before she left for Paris all those years ago. She felt like she was letting my beautiful mother down by leaving me. Poor dead Marie. Helene did the only thing she could think to do to ameliorate the guilt. She looked them up online and found their London address on Company's house. I was almost climbing across the table to hear what they'd said to her, to commit this new information to memory. I'd been to their house before many times, of course, before they'd moved to Spain full-time. I'd spent hours outside, watching, waiting, occasionally following their chauffeur-driven car when they went out. But speaking to them was a whole new level, and I was half impressed with Helene, and half furious that she'd never told me about this meeting before. She was clearly reluctant to tell me how bad the encounter was, not meeting my eyes when she explained that they initially slammed the door shut when she told them who she was. She didn't leave, though, and eventually they let her in and coldly disclosed that they knew all about me and my ghastly mother. My ears started to buzz as I let that sink in, and I scratched at my neck, waiting for the lump in my throat I knew would appear any second. They knew about me from the start, Helene explained, when their poor son turned up unexpectedly late one night and, pacing the living room, confessed that he'd got into some trouble. According to Jeremy, who did most of the talking while Kathleen sat rigidly on the sofa, sipping a large gin and tonic, Simon had asked how he should tell his wife, Janine, and told his father that some financial provision would have to be made for me. So he did want to do the right thing in some way, Helene said, almost apologetically, as she drank her wine and fiddled with her hair. I ignored the comment and told her to carry on. I had no interest in entertaining that man's pathetic attempts to salve his conscience. Jeremy proudly told Helene that he and his wife had spent several hours shutting this idea down, making him see that Marie had done it deliberately for money, warning him that Janine would never recover. Simon made a foolish mistake, as many young men do, he had told Helene, And I'm sorry that this young girl has to grow up without parents, but many people have faced worse. I myself lost my mother at a young age, and I didn't go round looking for handouts from strangers. Hélène said that she argued back, shouting that Marie had not gone out to trap their son, and trying to explain that she had not known how wealthy he was, or that he was married for that matter, until much later. But they would hear none of it. "That girl tried to ruin my son for money," shouted Kathleen, suddenly rising from her seat. "If you think your friend's daughter is going to start all this nonsense up again, you're as foolish as she was." And that was pretty much that. According to Hélène, who had downed her wine and was now gesticulating furiously, Kathleen had suddenly started sobbing and hitting her husband on the chest. He had grabbed her hands and forcefully pushed her back down onto the sofa before turning back to Hélène, who was standing, slightly stunned, by the door. "You've upset my wife and ruined our evening. I want you out of my house and don't even think about trying this crap with my son. We'll have lawyers on you so fast you'll be fucking homeless before you've seen us in court." "I was shaking a bit by then," said Hélène, "because he suddenly looked mad. His eyes were bulging and his carefully combed silver hair was flying about. And the weirdest thing was that his accent had completely changed. When he first spoke to me, he sounded like a proper English gentleman, but by the time I left, his voice was rough and hard, and he reminded me of the market traders I used to know in the town where I grew up. I'm sorry, I tried, but I thought his parents might be nicer, more sympathetic. I thought they'd want to know their beautiful granddaughter for God's sake, but no. They've done well for themselves, but underneath it all, Grace, they are thugs. So they're old, they're mean, and they take up precious space in the world. And all of this would be reason enough to help them meet their end in a more unpleasant way than might have originally been on the cards. But if I'm totally honest, it's mainly because they knew. They knew about my mother. They knew about me. And they didn't just flap their hands and do nothing. They actively lobbied their son, blaming Marie, Hélène, the clubs, his friends who led him astray. They blamed everyone but Simon. He shirked his responsibilities as a father, and his family helped him do it. I thought they were living their lives unaware that their son had rejected his child and left her mother struggling. But they wanted it that way. And in the end, that's what swung the decision. They die first. I get to the beach restaurant at 6 p.m, assuming that, like most old people, my grandparents eat early. I've asked for a spot on the terrace, but it turns out that the restaurant is much bigger than it looked online, and I'm anxious that I'll be too far away from them to glean anything useful. I order a glass of white wine. I like my wine. The Latimers always made sure they drank the good stuff. I chose a Rioja. And force myself to open up the book I've brought with me so it won't look too obvious when I start eavesdropping. I'd chosen The Count of Monte Cristo, which was far too on the nose, but I'd thought it funny when I was packing. I don't have to wait long for the Artemis party to arrive. Barely past page one, I see activity out of the corner of my eye. Two waiters are escorting four elderly people past the bar and towards the terrace. I stay still, not allowing myself to look up, but sensing that they are coming closer. A loud female voice. "No, not that table, Andreas. It's in direct sunlight. Put us over there." The party turns and moves to the other end of the space. "Fuck you, Kathleen." Once they're settled in their seats and have ordered drinks, all of which takes an age, with complaints about the wind and a dither about what to choose, I permit myself a quick scan of the scene. The aging Artemises are facing me, their friends opposite them. Kathleen has had a blow-dry that would leave Joan Collins spitting blood. Her hair is pale blonde and has a structure, not a style, set so rigidly that the wind she worried about won't dare to touch it. The cosmetic work on her face is visible from some distance, and her eyes have been deliberately given a slightly startled look, which I think is meant to be coquettish, but makes her look demented. She's wearing a beige tunic over beige trousers, with her obscenely large Chanel bag resting on the table. Her neck is adorned with a large string of... I can't make out the stone, but I can safely assume they aren't cubic zirconia. I have the luxury of a little staring, since they're all engrossed in the menu. I'm wondering if there's anything of me in this dissatisfied-looking woman, when she lifts her hands up and clasps them together and I see her nails. Pointed, painted in a classic pillar box red. There we are, Kathleen. My hands, holding my forgotten book, are long and slim, unlike hers. But my nails are bright red and pointed too. After a few minutes pretending to be immersed in my book, I call the waiter over and ask to move out of the direct sunlight. Not a moment too soon, since I have a sneaking suspicion that this wig could melt at any moment. The terrace is busy but not full, and I'm taken to a table just behind that of my targets. Much better. I want to hear what they're talking about. I won't learn anything insightful or interesting about their characters. They're too close-minded for that, but I might get an idea of their plans for the week. I'm only here for 5 more days, all the holiday I could take, so time is tight. I order another glass of wine and some assorted tapas and open my book up again. Jeremy is looking at me in a way that all women recognise. The old goat is sizing me up, appreciating my youth, not realising for a second how pathetic he looks. I smile for a brief moment, in part because it's amusing to see my grandfather checking me out, and partly to make him think I'm charmed. The moment is interrupted by waiters bringing their food. No order was taken, but upon seeing the dishes, I'm not surprised. Steak and fries for the whole party. It must be the only thing on the menu they go for. Steak and fries, never straying into foreign territory, never doing anything different, being small, turning nasty. And I got all that just from steak. Imagine what I could learn from their bookshelves. I'm kidding. They won't have any books in their house. They drone on about friends at the golf club, discussing someone called Brian who disgraced himself at the recent charity auction. Poor Brian. Imagine the shame of being cast out by the elderly expat community. Kathleen and the other woman dining, who looks a lot like Kathleen but with more girth and a smaller Chanel, move on to slagging off a hairdresser who takes too long and couldn't fit her friend in last Monday. My attention is wandering. I want to learn everything I can, but by God, these people don't make it easy. Can I have one more glass of wine, or will that sabotage this fact-finding mission? Fuck it. Glass of wine ordered, I pick at the remnants of my tapas. Perhaps the group I'm watching had the right idea when it came to the steak. The food I ordered is confusingly rubbery and looks less like it came from the sea and more like it was grown in a warehouse off a motorway. The group in front of me have ordered coffee, and Kathleen is fussing over a stain on Jeremy's tie, which looks as though it's a club tie of some sort. I bet Jeremy is a Freemason. It would just fit. Fat Friend's husband is asking when they will next be at the casino and mentions a drinks event this coming Thursday. Yes, we'll be there, says Jeremy sharply, brushing Kathleen's proffered napkin away. We're having dinner with the Berefords at 7:30 and we'll drop in on our way back. Where are you having dinner? I want to scream, but they don't elaborate. Instead, Jeremy asks for the bill by brusquely beckoning the waiter. The other man at the table grabs the saucer when the moment comes and does a nod towards my grandparents. We must get this. I'm sure it's our turn. No, please, I insist. A gold card is thrown down and Jeremy barely responds, instead looking over at me again. This time I look away. I don't want him to mark me or know my face too well. I'm not worried. I assume he spends a lot of time looking at women young enough to be his granddaughter. Perhaps less who actually are, but with Simon's track record, who could ever be sure? As they leave, I notice Jeremy's tie properly. I was wrong, not Freemasons. A print in green and yellow with the letters RC. A quick Google tells me it's the official tie for the Regency Club, a private members' establishment in Mayfair, opened in 1788 for men, royal and wealthy, to consort without their wives. I almost laugh. I know where you started life, Jeremy. In a two-room dwelling in Bethnal Green, with a seamstress mother and a father who fucked off and ended up who knows where before you were 5. Simon has talked about it in interviews with pride, as a sign of how hard your family has worked to rise in the world. So here you are in your tie, imagining it shows your pedigree, the one you bought for yourself. Admirable to some, perhaps. Even to me, since I'm trying to do the same thing, climb out of poverty, get away from my starting offer in life. But I know you. I know your hatred of your roots, whatever the story you've spun since. You saw it in me, and when asked to help your own flesh and blood out of a similar situation, you ran. Helene was right. You're just a thug, and your private club ties and your expensive clothes don't do much to conceal that. But wear your tie. Thursday isn't far away. I walk back to my rooms, taking in the main promenade in Puerto Banús as I go. The boutiques are filled with women holding up embellished dresses in the mirror and chatting to their friends. Teenage girls stroll past engrossed in a discussion about their tans. I wonder if I'd have been one of these empty shells had I grown up within the folds of the Artemis family. I read books, I follow world affairs, I have opinions on more than just shoes and golf clubs. I am better than these people, that's not in doubt. But they look happy despite their ignorance. Perhaps because of it. What is there to worry about? None of these idiots are thinking about climate change. They're wondering what to wear on the yacht tomorrow. But it's fascinating to watch, and I only have a short time to see it. Once I've done my job, I won't be coming back to this playground for the Diamante class. Perhaps I should buy a memento. I look at the shop windows, with their overpriced tat. I have neither the money nor the desire to buy a fur-cuffed caftan, even as a silly joke. Besides, I think I know what my keepsake will be, and it won't cost me a thing. The next day, after a quick run along the beach, I drive to their house. It's a large villa in a secure complex, hidden away from the unwashed masses and guarded by big gates and a bored security officer in a hut, who I imagine is supposed to check who visitors are, but lets me through with a wave when I say I'm here from the boutique after dark to drop off a dress for Mrs. Lyle at number 8. I guess that there would be a fairly steady stream of deliveries for the bored ladies alone in their pristine villas, always ordering a new outfit or demanding a nail technician visit at short notice. I didn't say I was going to the Artemis household. I don't want there to be an obvious link, just in case questions are asked later. Their house, number 9, is almost identical to numbers 8 and 10. White stucco, terracotta tiles leading up to the door. Palm trees on either side of the porch. Perfect green lawn, even in this scorching heat. I guess hosepipe bans don't apply when you live in a compound away from normal society. I take my foot off the pedal and roll by, but there's nothing to see, really. There's nobody in sight on these wide avenues, not a dog walker or a mother and buggy. All this money, and it can only buy silence. I appreciate silence, by the way. You don't grow up on a main road in London and not dream of the day you might live in a home without hearing your neighbours alternately having angry sex and or sobbing to the soundtrack of Les Miserables. But this calm is artificial. It feels flat and dull, as though made for people who wanted to create an environment which completely denied the loud reality of human life. The Artemis's choice of house only tells me about them insofar as it tells me nothing. It's a house which was built for rich people who don't care about design but really value security and status. Did Lynn and Brian buy a house in this compound? Well then let's buy a bigger one. That's it. There's no nod to personality, there's no activity. Only sanitised conformity. I leave feeling rather depressed. I share DNA with these people. Will I too one day hanker after beige carpets and a maid I can mistreat? I guess a maid would be nice, but I think I'd find their inevitable sadness a bit oppressive. I imagine it's a bonus for Kathleen, though. Someone who is more miserable than her, in full view every day. From the compound I travel to the casino, which is about a 30-minute drive along a fairly hairy road. A cliff edge on one side heads down towards a gorge? A ravine? I don't know. As I said, I grew up on a main road and have always had what I feel is a healthy suspicion of big open spaces. The countryside baffles me, and anywhere that takes 30 minutes by car isn't somewhere I'd waste my time going if I was at home. Sometimes I get the urge to have a quick meeting with a man. I mean sex, lower your eyebrows. Or just waste my time mindlessly scrolling on dating apps. I flick through chances posing in front of BMWs, as if that's a sign they've made it, instead of a clear indication that they are stupid enough to think that higher purchase makes good financial sense. But a tacky car and a V-neck t-shirt aren't necessarily complete no-nos. I'm not going to be spending my life with these men, after all. I don't even care enough to commit their names to memory. But I do have a firm line in the sand. If you're more than a couple of kilometres away, it's not happening. My mood is fleeting and I'm not waiting for you to change at King's Cross or text to say the overground has been replaced by a fleet of buses because of essential repairs. So the Spanish countryside is an alien world to me and fuck it, the cliff leads to a ravine. Whatever you'd call it, it's a long drop and the cliffside is covered in gnarly looking bushes. Plus, there isn't a soul to be seen on this route. Perfect. The sun is out, and the warm breeze hits my arm as I balance it on the door while I drive. I turn on the radio, and the local station is playing the Beach Boys. God only knows fills the little rental car, as I slowly hug the road and make my way towards the casino. I don't believe in God, obviously. We live in a time of science and the Kardashians, so I think I'm safely in the sane camp there. But also, any god with real clout wouldn't have paired me with these people and given me such a calling. So no god, but I do feel like someone is smiling down on me today. While I'm on God, there's a story in the Bible. I mean, it's not in the Bible. I heard it in a film, and it involves modern technology, which goes something like this. A man lives in a little house very happily for years, until one day the emergency services knock on his door and say, "Sir, there is a storm coming, we need to evacuate." And the man says, "Thank you, gentlemen, but I'm religious. I have faith. God will save me." The men leave and the storm comes. The waters rise around his house and a boat comes past. "Sir," says the captain, "come with us. The water will only rise." But the man says, "Thank you, gentlemen, but I'm religious. I have faith. God will save me." Later on, the man has to climb to his roof as the house floods. A helicopter hovers overhead. "Sir, climb up this ladder. We can get you to safety." The man waves them away. "Thank you, gentlemen, but I'm religious. I have faith. God will save me." Later on, the man drowns. When he gets to heaven, he meets God and says, "Father, I had faith. I believed in you. I stayed true. Why did you let me drown?" And God looks exasperated, and why wouldn't he? This man is an idiot, and says, "David, I sent you the emergency services, a boat and a helicopter. Why are you here?" "Someone has sent me, big, stupid Amir with his powerful cars, a definite date when my grandparents will be out late at night, and a windy, dangerous road. And unlike that stupid man in the fable, I fully intend to take advantage of them all. I have a little over 36 hours before I carry out my plans. I could spend the time following the couple around to learn more about them, but honestly, they're just not interesting enough to make it worthwhile. So I go to the beach for the rest of the afternoon, splashing out on a sunbed at a private beach and drinking rosé as I read a book about a woman who kills her husband after years of gaslighting and emotional abuse. I couldn't get on with The Count of Monte Cristo. Too close to the bone, I expect. I did flick to the back, though. A terrible habit, for sure. But my cheating nature was nevertheless rewarded with this line. All human wisdom is contained in these two words. Wait and hope. Wait and hope. I've been living this line since I was a teenager now, and finally the waiting part is coming to an end. I put my hands on my hot chest and try to feel if my heart is pounding faster than usual. But no, I'm breathing as normal, as if today is just another day and I'm not about to commit a terrible crime. How strange. My mind is going over and over the plan, and the anticipation is rising like steam, ready to burst out of my ears, and yet here I lie, shielded by dark glasses, heart refusing to betray me by bursting out of my chest. My body is ready, even if my mind is behaving like a teenager getting ready for a first date. Later that evening, before I get into bed, I send Amir a text from my newly acquired burner phone. That's what Edward Snowden called a phone that you buy to try and stay untraceable. A little grand in my case, given that I'm not aware of any state secrets, but a good tip nonetheless, and a 20-minute trip to a less salubrious part of London, plus 60 quid in cash, got me this rather quaint old flip phone, which I added credit to so that I could text. It won't make its way back to England, but it's serving a useful purpose. I ask Amir if he's around tomorrow and whether he could sort me a car for a couple of days. I've told him that I'm travelling further into the countryside for the night and would feel safer in a bigger car, which is sort of true, I suppose. The best lies have a kernel of truth, making it easier to stick to your story and less likely to get caught up in different versions. My friend Jimmy has a terrible lying face. The corners of his mouth automatically turn up in a smirk when he fibs. It's sort of endearing, but it makes it impossible to trust him with anything, given his tendency to get caught out when confronted. When I wake up, I check my phone immediately. As I suspected, Amir replied in the early hours of the morning. A big night out at Glitter, I imagine. I text right back, thanking him for his offer of a night out, but explaining again that I'll be leaving this afternoon. I know I'm not getting away with just a straight key handover, so I suggest meeting at an ice cream parlour on the Calle Ribera at 2 p.m. I know I won't hear from him until at least midday, given the amount of champagne I imagine he imbibed last night. So I hop in the tiny shower and throw on a sundress I hope makes me look slightly dowdy in Amir's eyes. Certainly it's devoid of any shimmer or stretch, and so is practically a boiler suit in comparison to what most of the women in this place choose to wear. In my short time here, it has come to feel as though a mix of sequins, gold buttons, and animal prints form some sort of unofficial uniform. Well, that and the blow-up, rubbery lips that make these women look as though they're in the midst of a terrible allergic reaction to the iced coffee they sip on as they sunbathe. I don't plan on coming back to this apartment, though I've booked it out until Saturday. I might be being too optimistic, but I don't want to allow doubt to creep in at this crucial moment. I tidy up, throw the bedsheets in the washing machine and wipe down the surfaces. I pack my small bag up and then lay out what I'll need for the rest of the day. In my crossbody bag, it's Gucci, one of the first things I bought when I started my new job, and even the ladies of Marbella would be impressed. I place my burner phone, wig, euros, folded up plimsolls, a torch, latex gloves, a travel-sized perfume bottle of liquid, and a box of matches. Everything else goes in the hold-all, including my real phone, passport, and credit cards. I lock the apartment and take the key just in case. In a fit of paranoia, I wipe down the door handle with my sleeve and realise I need to be better at this. If I'm going to carry on without being caught, a quick wipe down of random surfaces isn't going to cut it. Ah well, this is the test balloon. The car is parked a good 30-minute walk away, far away from the bustle on the main drag. I didn't want it to be recorded in a car park, and this was the closest I could get to the apartment without risking it being towed away within seconds. It's boiling already, and sweat is running down my chest and pooling underneath my bra. I dump the hold-all under the driver's seat and check it's not visible from all angles. Then I walk back into town, taking a different route by mistake and ending up by the sea. After a couple of hours whiling away the time at a cafe where a coffee seems to cost €5, Amir finally texts. Hi, babes. I'm steaming off of last night. You missed a proper big one. We'll be at the Oceana Club from 3 to get it on again. Meet me there for a drink and I'll sort you out. Smiley face. His reply almost makes me rethink. I cannot engage with a grown-up who seems not to possess the ability to use basic English, even in text. It's just bad manners, and on top of that, it implies a level of ignorance that you might forgive in a teenager but is appalling in an adult. You can only blame a poor education for so much. My secondary school was hardly Hogwarts, but I still took the time to learn the difference between there and there. I doubt Amir did even that. Not for the first time, I wonder what he does to earn so much money. I doubt it's entirely kosher, but who am I to lecture on morality? I consider using my little rental and decide to stick with Amir's offer. I'll just have to be stern, shut down all offers of alcohol and leave as soon as I get the car keys. Ugh, I resent having to rely on a man, and worse, a man who wears wraparound shades, for help in any matter that really should be done by me and me alone. But I have to be realistic. And Amir won't be getting anything good from this interaction. If it all goes to plan, he'll be none the wiser. If it goes tits up, he'll be in a world of trouble. This cheers me up a little, and I drain my coffee. I arrive at the Oceana Club just before 3 p.m. The place is enormous, a palace of vacuous frivolity. I assume it's mainly one big bar, but souped up on steroids. The driveway is littered with sports cars in lurid colours, each being dealt with by harassed-looking valets in white jackets. A Rolls-Royce parked haphazardly in front of the entrance displays the number plate B055B01. Boss boy. I wait at reception while a girl with a tan, which the sun would reject outright as being beyond its powers, speaks on the phone in estuary English. Eventually, she turns her attention on me. I imagine she's unimpressed by my brown hair, sans extensions, and my flat sandals. I'm wearing red lipstick, which I always wear when I feel like I need a shield of sorts. But apart from that, I look fairly plain. I like plain. I have a somewhat beautiful face, and I don't feel arrogant saying it. Women always backpedal when they slip up and admit that they are attractive, a lifetime of being told by men not to be up ourselves. Be as beautiful as possible, but make sure it seems effortless and, crucially, never acknowledge it. Run away from any man who says you're beautiful but you don't know it. The same men want you to be constantly up for sex but never take charge of your own enjoyment. I'm pretty nice looking. Not tall, but slim and in proportion. Dark hair, symmetrical features, a nice full mouth without being too pouty. I like looking at my reflection, but I'm not obsessed with it. I know my appearance helps me out in life, but I'm not my mother, too reliant on her beauty and left to flounder when it's not enough. My look is probably incredibly disappointing to the men in Marbella compared to the peacocks you see around here. Coco Chanel supposedly once said that you should take off one accessory before you leave the house. These girls would scratch old Coco's eyes out with their acrylic nails before they did that. I tell Miss Tan that I'm meeting Amir, and her face changes. Clearly he's a valued customer. As I'm whisked through the marble hallways and past a library bar filled with fake books and objects which look old but I'm willing to bet are bulk bought from a supplier who churns this crap out for those wanting to look authentic but care nothing for true provenance. We emerge outside, into the blinding sun and what looks like a theme park for adults. There are several linking pools, each with a bar in the middle, where people have swum up and are enjoying cocktails underneath straw parasols. House music blares and waiters walk briskly between lounges, topping up drinks. Some people have whole beds laid out under canopies where several people lie around smoking and chatting. Nobody is sporting anything more than swimwear, apart from me, and I have no intention of joining them. I spy an actual belly chain of all things. Jewellery for the waist. For when you run out of places to flaunt your diamonds, Coco Chanel would die. Mr. Amir is not here yet. Please relax and have a drink. I'm almost pushed down onto a large white lounger where I am conspicuous only in my solitude. I order a tonic water in the hope that Amir will think I'm already on it and wait. My new friend is only 45 minutes late. Time I spend watching the bronzed girls rolling down their already tiny bikinis to get more sun, and staring at the men with their shaved chests and mini bum bags preening and showing off, mainly, it seems, to each other. I spot Amir as he walks through the sun lounges. He'd be hard to miss, dressed as he is, in neon orange shorts and surrounded by a posse of lads, all of whom seem to signal that their main aim in life is to look as much like their leader as possible. Waiters appear from all sides, bringing towels, glasses, ice buckets, and bizarrely, a coconut. Amir reaches the lounger where I'm sitting and peers down at me over his sunglasses. Hello, gorgeous. This is Stevie, JJ, Fat Lad, Cooper and Nige. He gestures to the posse, all of whom nod disinterestedly, already looking at the bikini girls next to us. I wonder why Fat Lad has been given such a harsh moniker, given that his body fat percentage looks to hover in the single digits. I can only see muscles, more than a person should rightly have unless they have a physical job, and I rather doubt that Fat Lad has a job of any kind. Amir grabs the coconut and throws it to the gentleman he called Nige, who bounces it hard against his head to loud roars of appreciation. Not satisfied, Nige tries again, and the fruit breaks open. He climbs onto the sun lounger and holds the pieces high in the air as bikini girls and muscle boys alike holler excitedly. It's his best trick, says Amir proudly. He practiced that for 8 summers in a row until he managed it. We're trying to get him on that talent show where dogs do magic. I feel a slight sense of panic spreading through my veins as I envisage an entire afternoon spent watching these people practice their mating rituals around a tiny swimming pool, presumably contaminated by oil, fake tan and fag ash. I must be sterner in my mission and not allow Amir to dictate my day. With this new resolve, I reach over and hold his wrist until he turns and focuses his full attention on me. I'm really sorry, but you guys were a bit late and I only have another hour before the next part of my journey. Did you bring the car here? Only I don't have masses of time. He looks at me for a minute and then throws his head back and laughs. The beefy posse behind him echo his snorts, despite not being near enough to have heard what I said. I guess whoever pays for the drinks commands a full-time rapturous audience. Babes, I don't even know your name. Calm down, Speedy. I have a car for you here, but let's hang out for a bit. Get into it. Mix it up, yeah? I suppress the shudder I experience upon hearing such nonsensical bollocks and allow my shoulders to drop slightly. My name's Amy, I say, smiling, and I'd definitely be up for mixing it up for a while. I end up spending nearly 2 hours with Amir and his growing group. I try to lean into it, but it's not easy. Champagne is sprayed, girls are lured over, music is turned up on request. Amir's attention span is limited, to put it mildly, and I have to wait patiently as he jumps up and down several times, often just to shout "tune" to nobody in particular. I tell him that I work in corporate events and emphasise that I just broke up with my boyfriend, so I'm not looking for anything romantic. Luckily, Amir seems to be genuinely uninterested in anything like that. He's clearly a guy who collects friends and chases a good time. Perhaps there's not much else to it. Makes a change. I check my watch several times, and when I can't stand it anymore, I tell him I've run out of time and really have to go. It's the truth. I don't have too long before I need to be in position at Dinero. He rolls his eyes, but gets up and signals to JJ, who scurries over, practically knocking a bikini-clad lovely into the pool in his haste. "Get the Hummer brought round, mate," Amir orders and takes a sip of champagne. "You're a funny one, Amy. I didn't think you was into our chat on the plane, didn't think I'd hear from you again. But nobody can resist Amir in the end." He puts his arm on my back and steers me towards the building where we walk through as waiters back against walls. "This car is a sweet ride, darling, but it's powerful. It's a beast. Will you be okay with that? Can you handle the ride?" I assure him that I've got loads of experience with big cars, which is a total lie, and I don't ask what a Hummer is, which is a wise decision. We wait outside for the car to be driven round, and Amir tells me to enjoy it and not to worry about bringing it back until Sunday. It'll be back well before that, but I just smile and thank him. A tank appears on cue. The noise is startling and I flinch momentarily. Amir laughs at this and high-fives JJ as he hands over the keys. This car is enormous. Tinted windows and matte black alloys. He makes me practice on the driveway with him a few times, pointing out the chrome finish and the triple suspension or something. I clutch the steering wheel and hover my foot over the brake cautiously, wondering whether this is a good idea after all. But when I dare to put my foot down, I realise the power in this machine will serve me well. I tell Amir how great this will be for my little trip and gush over how my friend will love the drive. "Girls love big cars, innit? Look proper sexy in them. Just don't mess my baby up. I want to take it to the south of France next week." I feel momentarily guilty that I'm almost certainly going to, if not total his baby, then at least inflict some serious cosmetic damage on it. Still, nothing that a wad of cash can't fix, and from what I've seen today, Amir has no problems on that front. He tells me to drop the car at the club whenever I'm ready, and with that, he winks, gives me a bear hug, and walks back inside. I sit in the car for a minute, enveloped in the lingering smell of his woody aftershave, marvelling at my luck. A man who knows nothing about me has given me a car without quibbling about insurance, proof of ID, or even a guarantee I know how to drive. My little hire car is safely tucked away in a side street, and I am free to carry out my plan with even less of a footprint than I imagined. I wonder if it's a trap. But since nobody knows my plans, I shake that thought off. It's now 6:30 p.m. Time flies when alcohol is being sprayed all over you. I know that Jeremy said they would head to the casino after dinner, so I guess they will get there around 9:30. I'm not going to follow them around all evening. For one thing, I don't want anyone to clock the car, so I drive very slowly towards Marbella, hoping to find some food that isn't chicken goujons or soggy chips. As I sip a bowl of soup, I breathe slowly and force my foot to stop tapping. Marie used to ask me to list the top 5 moments of the day, to remember how lucky we are. I haven't done this since she died, but today seems like a good time to take stock. Today, as terminally earnest people like to say, is the first day of the rest of my life. Perhaps it's the first day my life properly begins. So much of it has been focused on getting here. My childhood was brief, my teenage years a frustrating waiting room on the way to adulthood. My 20s have been functional, a means to an end. I've not felt that lucky. Sorry, Marie. You left me too early, and fortune never smiled that brightly as a result. So I might not manage to list 5 top moments, but maybe 1 is enough for now? Let's start small and see what happens. At 8:45 p.m, I pay my bill and head back to the enormous wagon parked across the road from the restaurant. I wonder if there's an inverse correlation between money and taste. Amir's predilection for chrome seems to suggest there might be. As does Jeremy and Kathleen's house, for that matter. But these people are new money, or nouveau riche, as Jimmy's mum was guiltily fond of saying. Perhaps the older your cash, the better your eye. If I pull this off, I'll be richer than Croesus, but thoroughly nouveau. Perhaps I'll develop an eye for bronze and beige and bling, but I doubt it. That probably means taste is more to do with whether you're ghastly or not. The Artemis family would certainly back that up. I don't put my destination in the sat-nav, just in case Amir looks, or the police do find the car. Instead, I have a little map which I bought at the airport for €6. I've checked out the route many times now, and I've got plenty of time if I do get lost. I pull the wig out of my bag and wince at how bedraggled it looks from just one wear. Buy cheap, pay dear, as Jimmy's mum says. Next time I'll invest some proper money in a disguise. I drive up winding dark roads in silence, never going above 30 kilometres per hour. There's barely a car on the road, but I wonder whether the casino visitors will change that as I get closer. I'll only get one chance at this, and if there's any sign of another car, I just can't risk it. Fuck. It has to work. It has to. The casino is in the middle of nowhere, but surrounded by a strange little cluster of restaurants and bars, which means I can park in the car park with no fear of sticking out like a sore thumb. I do a quick stroll around it to ensure that the Artemis's Mercedes isn't yet here, and then I head over to the entrance. I'm not going in. For one thing, I'm not a member, and for another, I don't want to be picked up on the casino CCTV. Instead, I hover in the darkness between the club and a bar called Ray's. This place looks like an out-of-town shopping centre, and I half expect to see a home base. It's hardly glamorous. I'm surprised that my grandparents deigned to visit. Then again, they choose to spend their old age in a gated community in Marbella, a place which makes Florida look like Renaissance Italy in terms of culture. I'm angry that I've given myself so much time. I'd bet on my grandparents being the kind of people who worry if they're not home by 11 p.m, but what if they're secret night owls? I can hardly hang around the car park with a few sparse bushes for cover. I lose my nerve and head back to the car, to regroup and to go over the route again. As I'm walking, a silver saloon creeps up the drive, hogging the middle of the road, headlights on full beam. I hold my breath, squinting at the number plate, but it's unnecessary. I see Mrs. Artemis, her miserable expression, and the resplendent blow-dry which frames it in the glass. I hear a giggle and quickly retreat between two cars until I realise that the sound came from me. I'm clearly more excited than I'd thought. At least part of me is looking forward to this. The elderly couple get out of the car slowly, Jeremy throwing the keys to the valet and barely glancing at his wife, who's gingerly stepping onto the pavement, clutching her Chanel like a child holds onto a teddy bear. They head into the casino without a word to the valet or the doorman, just silent statues there to show respect to the great and the good, I suppose. Still, statues can't wipe their arse on your leather seats like a valet can, and hopefully does. For the next 2.5 hours, I sit in my car. I eat a disgusting cheeseburger and resolve to give up meat when I get home. I smoke 3 cigarettes and vow to quit back in London. I listen to some terrible Spanish radio and veer between manically tapping my feet and obsessively checking my mirrors to see whether the Artemises have emerged yet. A younger crowd is pulling up. It seems the casino gets livelier as the night goes on. I'm guessing that this probably means the olds push off earlier, and I'm right. The steps are soon busy with women swathed in Hermes scarves and men waving car tickets. They are all wearing expressions which signal a mix of wealth and angry entitlement. Bang, there they are. Kathleen with a gift bag, stumbling just a little. Jeremy with a cigar. Must have been a fun night. I'm glad. I'm not a monster. It's nice that they're leaving the world on a high note. It's more than Marie was given. But I must be the better person here. I'm going to decimate their entire family. The least I can allow them is a goodie bag and a spin at the roulette table. They head down the steps and Jeremy gives the valet their ticket. This is my cue. I turn on the engine and head out of the car park. I've told you I haven't planned this, and I'm not being falsely modest. I have a vague idea, which seemed pretty solid back in London. But now I'm here, I'm not in any way confident that I'll even get the chance to try it out. But I'm here, driving fast down the windy roads below the casino, following the route the Artemis seniors will hopefully take to their villa. After a few minutes, I turn onto the cliff road, darker and more bumpy. I estimate that I'm about 10 minutes ahead of the couple if they drive cautiously, and I need to find the right spot. I marked it the other day, but in the dark, the road seems to want to conceal it. I'm going too fast, and I can feel the lump in my throat taking up its usual place, threatening to overwhelm me. Where is this fucking spot? I breathe through my nose and talk to myself out loud. You'll find it. You've got time, Grace. It's okay. I drive past and brake, just like they teach you to do in lessons, as if anyone ever does a perfect emergency stop in real life without causing a pile-up. But the road is dead, and all I can hear is cicadas. I do a U-turn, which takes a few goes in this ridiculous vehicle, and pull into the lay-by, letting my breathing return to normal, waiting for the lump to go. I've got a clear view of the road from here, and if I'd missed this spot, I wouldn't have had another before they arrived home. I wait, drinking in the silence. Headlights. A car, dipping in and out of view as it winds down towards me. I've got 2 minutes. I rev the engine, as if this tank needs some extra persuasion, and drive, holding the steering wheel with locked arms. The car comes into view. They are slow, cautious, taking their time. As I abruptly spin the wheel and accelerate towards them, I see Kathleen's mouth form a perfect O before she covers her head and the lights blind me. The impact of my swerve forces me back into my seat and I brake fast. The car almost bucks from the command, as if annoyed by the interruption. As I rub my head and look up, all I can see is dust from the road and a satisfyingly large gap in the stubby bushes on the side of the cliff. I pull the car over, tuck it into the other side of the road and turn off the lights. I've got a little time before I have to head back, leaving Amir's car at the club before I retrieve my hire car to go to the airport. I grab my torch and shakily pull on the latex gloves, breaking the thumb portion on my left hand. The matches and the little perfume bottle go in my pocket. I cross the road and hover on the cliff edge. My plimsolls aren't up for a big scramble, and I can't quite see how far the car has travelled until a scan with the torch shows it about 15 metres down and upside down, cradled by a bush. I should really turn back, get to the airport, leave the scene clean. Whatever happens now, I can get away. But where would the fun be in my grandparents dying without ever knowing my role in it all? It's vanity, really, and I'm inexperienced in the art of murder. Next time I won't allow myself this indulgence. But I climb down the cliff, holding on to bits of scrubby plants and crouching low so I don't tumble towards the darkness. I reach the car. It's hard to tell what's happening inside since branches seem to crisscross the doors. I shuffle up the car on the driver's side and twist my head upside down, shining my torch into the glass. Jeremy is suspended, his head hanging over the seatbelt. He looks uninjured, apart from being very definitely unconscious and upside down. Kathleen is clearly dead. No forensic expertise needed here, since you definitely need your head to be attached to your body to stay alive, and a tree branch has considerately removed that requirement for me. I yank at Jeremy's door, but nothing happens. So I try the door behind his seat, and it opens enough for me to be able to squeeze my head in, just behind his seat rest. I stroke his haughty face, now thin and bleeding, and listen to his ragged breathing. I get as close as I can, which is difficult as he's upside down and I'm twisting like a pretzel, and whisper his name. His eyes open a crack, and he whimpers as I begin to speak. Kathleen is dead, Jeremy. I'm so sorry. I don't think you're going to make it either, but you're not alone. Do you recognise me? I'm Grace, your granddaughter, Simon's daughter. He twitches ever so slightly. Yes. Marie's child. I'm so sorry that we never met before, well, this sad day. But then you made sure of that, didn't you? You didn't want me anywhere near your family. That's all right, Jeremy. I don't think we'd have got along, really. But it wasn't kind, was it? And so now you have to go, I'm afraid. Not for me, you see, but for my mother. Family first. I know you understand that. Oh, and it's not just you and your wife, Jeremy. That's the really good bit. Pulling out the perfume bottle, I turn his head towards me as gently as I can and look into a single grey eye. I'm going to kill your whole family. As I say it, I yank his tie towards me and he slumps. I pull it from his collar, carefully roll it up and stuff it into my pocket. My little Spanish souvenir. Then I open the bottle and strike a match. Chapter 2. The guards bang on our cells at 8 a.m. before handing over breakfast on a tray and departing. Obviously, it's not poached eggs and fresh